100.5 means non-commercial, listener-powered, community radio. 100.5 means music, public affairs,
I have a dream,
and arts programming.
I wish I loved the human race. I wish I loved its city face.
You won't find anywhere else on the radio dial. 100.5 is not owned by a huge corporation. We are owned and operated by people like you, by your community. 100.5 CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio. Find our complete program schedule at coopradio.org.
You are listening to CFRO Community Radio Station. The upcoming show, Conscious Living Radio, is a program that explores frontiers of consciousness, spirituality, personal growth, emerging paradigms in psychology, health, science, and innovative philosophies that reflect commitment to the advancement of individual, social, and global transformation.
Control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Three, two, check ignition, and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. Thank you.
everyone. We're live on Facebook, and the station still is closed, so we're recording here and then playing the show Wednesdays 6 to 7 p.m. on Co-op Radio, Conscious Living Radio, 100.5 FM in Vancouver. I'm Tasha Sims.
And I'm Mark Caron.
And we're back together, which I'm really excited about, yeah. Mark.
We Great. Haven't done I'm one excited together. Too. No, it's been a little while.
Been a while. I don't know if you heard. I just thought I'd mention that Health Canada, did you hear the latest news about Health Canada it legalizing basically the first case of psilocybin being used in the treatment of terminal illness?
Therapsil. Yes.
Yeah. So that's kind of exciting. It's happening, I think, this coming week in Saskatoon.
Well, it's great news just for the the movement of decriminalizing nature. And for the healing properties
and
of
healing.
Plant medicines, absolutely. Yeah. It's great news. The whole community's just been ecstatic all week. So thanks for bringing that up. That's really great news.
So our guest is Philippe Cibot. He holds an MA in myth, cosmology, and the sacred from Canterbury Christ Church University. He's a longtime dedicated student of astrology. He's a trustee and a writer for the Gaia Foundation, an international London-based NGO, which has been working for 35 years with Indigenous people to uphold Earth-centered perspectives. He also co-runs Umuntu Microfinance, an NGO that he set up in 2010 to provide small-scale loans to disadvantaged women in Malawi. And in today's interview, we're discussing his recent book, Scavengers of Beauty, a personal, cultural, and symbolic exploration of the moon landing. More than 50 years after the 1969 Apollo mission, Philippe's going to offer his unique interpretation of the symbolism behind the moon landing. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. So your book, Scavengers of Beauty, it's an interesting mix of personal narrative and cultural symbolic interpretation. Really, like, sometimes it felt like I was reading the way I have to approach poetry. I have to sort of enter it instead of just trying to understand or think about what you're saying. It's so rich. I'm curious what inspired you to write the book and what was your intention?
Okay. Really, the starting point of the book, of the whole project is I've always wondered why the mission to the moon was named after Apollo, who was the god of the sun, and was not named after a moon goddess. At first, I thought it was quite an obvious question, and I kind of researched a little bit on the internet and found that really nobody had treated that subject. So that was the starting point, is to look at the symbolism of sun and moon and try to have a symbolic take on this Apollo mission being named after the god of the sun while we are going to the moon. So that's the first brick to the building, if you want. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, it becomes personal in the sense that I started to study astrology maybe 12 years ago. And then I realized that in my own personal birth chart, I was born on a full moon. And a full moon is basically an opposition between the sun and the moon. So when I, started to look into that, I realized that my exploration of sun and moon symbolism, even though I look at it from a collective narrative, comes back to the personal, because by addressing this symbolism, sun and moon, I'm also addressing my own astrological chart, if you want, and my own fabric, so to speak.
Why did you call it Scavengers of Beauty?
That's a very good question. I had so much resistance from people around me about that title, because of course, scavengers brings forth images of not very nice animals, but for me actually scavengers are very noble and perform a wonderful task in nature. And I think our world actually needs scavenging, because we are generating so much waste that is just being whatever.
So scavenging, I think, is a very noble activity. But anyway, the starting, it's, as you said, it's a kind of poetic take. The scavengers of beauty for me are people who are ready or are willing to find beauty even in the ugliest spot. So that's why they are scavenging, because even in what could be a corpse, you know, an animal would see a corpse, but within the corpse would find nourishment. So that's my own take on the scavengers of beauty. It's the ability to find beauty even in the you know, less beautiful spot.
Right. So we're the scavengers in this story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And tell us what you see the difference between the sun and moon symbolism. Let's do a few of these areas, if we could cover them, that the book does before we dive into the moon and the exploration, which I know, Mark, you're super fascinated with.
Okay. What I've been really trying to do in the book is to trace or to draw a kind of arc of development of consciousness and in very symbolic terms around the sun and the moon. What I want to say, first of all, is that I'm not pretending to come up with truth, you know, it's a poetic take, I would say. And the way I look at it is when I look back very far back into human history, what I see is the moon. The moon being the most important object in the sky. And the moon was associated with the earth and with the earth goddesses. And when we look at the very old artworks, what we see is representations, usually statues, small statues of earth goddesses or of the feminine. And I think the moon for many, many thousands of years was the main object in the sky. And again, was associated with earth and with the feminine principle mainly. And at some point in human history, which, you know, people like Joseph Campbell, for instance, the mythologist, trace around 2000 to 5000 BC, the earth goddesses were replaced with sky gods. Jupiter, Zeus, for instance, is one of them, maybe the most famous one. And with these sky gods, the moon was superseded with the sun. So we can say that lunar consciousness, which was mainly feminine and matriarchal, was replaced with solar consciousness, which was much more masculine and patriarchal. Now, I don't want to simplify things. You know, I'm really painting a very, very in very broad strokes, and I can be challenged on that. I totally accept that. So I'm really painting in broad strokes, but I think it's hard to disagree with the fact that we have seen in the evolution of human consciousness this superseding of the moon as the main symbolic and literal object in the sky with the sun. And with that, I call that solar consciousness or lunar consciousness. This solar consciousness is the consciousness we've been living with for 5,000 years now.
And so is the triumph of rationality, science, technology? Is that how Apollonian consciousness, if you will, is that how you describe it?
That's how I describe it, absolutely. So it has become that increasingly in the last, say, 300 years with the scientific revolution. But yeah, for the last 5,000 years, it was indeed, we've seen gradually, the advent of rationalism and professionalism and excellence and the tendency to look at things or to look at things to break things into separate parts instead of looking at the whole. So the way I put it is, for instance, a lunar consciousness, the moon, of course, both dies and is reborn in an endless cycle. So the lunar consciousness accommodates both living and dying. So I call it a both-and consciousness, while solar consciousness is very, very much stuck in polarity. It's either or. And this was formulated by Aristotle, for instance, when he said that A and A are exclusive. You cannot have A and not A. It's one or the other. And for me, that's a very defining characteristic of solar consciousness, is this very strong polarity, which does not accommodate, is less whole than a lunar consciousness. It's a different way to look at things, at the world, really. So yes, you're right, Apollo has become too symbolized this solar consciousness, becoming the god of the sun, while initially he was not the god of the sun, but little by little he took over the mantle of being the god of the sun from Helios, and Apollo has come to symbolize this extreme clarity and objectivity, rationality. Yeah.
What do you think the impact on the Earth has been because of this revering of the sun versus still being in touch with the qualities of the moon and the more feminine, if you will?
Well, I think you just have to open any newspaper and you can see what this consciousness has done to the Earth. I think it's a consciousness which, of course, took us to the moon and has brought many benefits. I'm not throwing the baby, but it's also a consciousness that is separating and objectifying and has disconnected us from Earth. Mm-hmm. With the consequences that we see today,
right,
in terms of, you know, the environment and, you know, the way we interact, the way we engage with the Earth,
and
or
this,
rather we don't.
The way you talk about polarity, I mean, certainly when I look at the world today, I think it's an increasing level of reactivity everywhere where there's us and them. It's as if it's, you know, recently especially illuminating how polarized different
yeah.
factions are. And people have so many stories and so many ideas of why they're on different sides.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, when you mention in the book that Carl Jung said consciousness arose out of polarity, I just wonder if you, I think it was around, you were asking the question in the book, what if there was a third object in the sky? What would
yeah.
that have done to consciousness? So I wonder if you could answer, how would you answer that question? What if there was a third object? Can you paint a picture of just, that might somehow support us to free ourselves of this very narrow, this or that kind of thinking?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can come up with an answer to that. It was a little bit cheeky for me just to imagine, because sun and moon are so amazingly polarized when you look at them, and the fact that they are of the same size in the sky, of course, is absolutely mm-hmm. incredible. One for the day, one for the night. I mean, it's fascinating. So I was just thinking, was polarity born of this striking polarity in the sky, and therefore if a third object, a second moon maybe, was out there, maybe consciousness would have evolved differently? But of course I don't think anybody can answer that that question.
But,
it was a
but
bit,
maybe
a
we
bit
need
cheeky
to...
but anyway the, I think the book
I was going to say maybe
yeah.
we need to answer the question, because it would create the vision of where we need to go. Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to,
yeah.
to break us out of that narrow trap of polarity thinking.
Mm-hmm.
What would that look like? I guess that's really what, you know, what's driving my question is, what would it look like if there always was a third choice, or as opposed to yes or no, or this or that, there was something more than three choices. What do you think that would do to both to the Earth and to the individual in a way, in terms of how we live?
Actually, in a sense, the book answered that question. The third object for me is the Earth, actually, because the way I look at it symbolically, and one potential take on this Apollo mission for me, and the most, the most useful one, so to speak, is to look at Apollo, god of the sun, going to the moon, and therefore realizing the idea chemical marriage of sun and moon, Eros Gamos, you know, And when this alchemical marriage takes place between sun and moon, it gives birth to the divine child. And the way I look at it is, for me, the divine child is Earth. And therefore, if I think the way forward is to realize this union of sun and moon on Earth. That's really what I'm trying to say.
I love it. And what would that mean? Let's take it to the words masculine and feminine, because you had, we're, again, I think most of our listeners would know we're not talking about gender. We're talking about qualities that are in all of us, both masculine and feminine. And if it's separate with the sun and the moon, and now you're talking about an integration, what do you think that would look like in human beings if we actually balance these two potential polarities? If this child took the best from the mother and the best from the father, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think it would certainly make us more complete, more whole, and it would definitely profoundly alter our relation to Earth. I think it would definitely bring about much more compassion and ability to attune to the rhythm of the Earth and to her pulse, really. And that's what we need, because at the moment we are stuck in a completely objectifying consciousness that has separated us from the rhythm of the Earth for centuries now. So realizing this sacred marriage, so to speak, that also not only the alchemists speak about it, but Jung and other psychologists use this analogy to talk about, of course, the realization of sun and moon within the individual, within the psyche. And I suppose that's also what brings back to my own chart, astrological chart, when I see this sun and moon opposition. I'm also trying to realize this sacred marriage. And by writing the book, I've been trying to address that in me as well. Yeah. But of course, we all have to address it in ourselves.
Yeah. Do you want to dive into some moon questions, Mark?
Well, before that, I had an interesting question pop up in my head that we talked about, and it was kind of from your question, Tasha, about the, you know, what would it look like if we kind of balanced both? And then what came up for me was, as we see in the evolution of mankind right now with transgendered and the way sexuality is changing within, our physical world, which goes into our spiritual, our energetic space, because we're seeing, just a huge acceptance.
And fluidity.
Yes, exactly. And I wonder how that might be related to what we're talking about here, because it's something that we're seeing is because, with a lot of transgender people, they have this beautiful balance and beautiful understanding of so much more than, say, a guy all in his masculine really gets, or a woman all in her feminine in a way. Because they're getting, as Philip was saying, the best of both worlds. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I haven't talked about the transgender movement in my book at all, but the way I look at it myself is I see it as a symptom, if you want, of this unconscious drive to rebalance male and female, or lunar and solar, or whatever, however we want to express that. To me, it is the expression of an unconscious need to rebalance the two poles, masculine and feminine. That's how I look at it,
Oh, we just lost your sound, Mark.
Oh, that's me and my microphone. You're talking about asking me if I had some moon questions. Well, first, I wanted to just acknowledge, Philip, what you're talking about in the book in terms of the astrological timing of the mission to the moon.
Yeah.
And, you asked the question, did NASA plan this? Because there was a whole bunch of interesting timings in terms, especially in the landing on the moon and the timing of the landing on the moon, that met up with a lot of astrological significances. And you even asked yourself the question in the book, did NASA even plan this? Were they consciously aware of what they were doing and how they plan that whole trip. So maybe you can kind of shine some light on that for our listeners.
Yeah, I think we are touching here on the mystery of astrology and the mystery of why on earth does astrology work, so to speak, although I don't like that word. It's a bit too functional. But why is astrology so relevant symbolically whenever we look at events or personalities, characters? Why is astrology so incredibly relevant? So I looked at the astrology of the mission to the moon, and I found indeed some quite puzzling so-called coincidences. And I suppose there are two ways to look at that. One of them is to say, well, you shouldn't be surprised. Astrology always, you know, whenever you look at something from an astrological angle, you will come up with something that is really puzzling. And that's, again, that's, as I said, touching the mystery of what astrology is, really. The other side of the question is, actually, did NASA or esoteric leaning than it is usually credited with? NASA, of course, is this summum of scientific excellence and technological excellence, but I don't think we think about NASA so much in terms of, you know, esoteric leanings, including astrology. But when I looked at the astrology of the mission, I really wondered whether NASA is actually quite conversant and in using magic, so to speak. Although it's a very, maybe it's a word that would make some people uncomfortable, but magic in the sense of using the art of astrology and other practices in order to achieve success for the mission. That's what I'm wondering aloud. I'm not saying I come up with answers, yes or no, because anyway, I don't try to come up with any answer, yes or no, in the book. As I said at the beginning of the book, it's more about the ability and the freedom to ask questions rather than to come up with answers. So that's a question, you know. I think that's an interesting one about NASA and the esoteric leanings of the organization in order to achieve success.
But also highly Christian. I mean, with that part in the book, I'm going, I didn't know that. I didn't know that when the astronauts got there that they did first communion, or not first, it wouldn't be called first communion, basically, which is for those of our listeners who don't have a Catholic background or a Christian background, it's the celebration or the intake of Christ's body and blood. Literally, it's a sacrament, right? I had no idea that they did that. Do you want to tell us a bit more about
that? It was the first on the moon, though, Tasha.
The first
communion, if you would call it, on the moon.
You're right. In Catholic school, they call it, the first time you do it, it's called first communion. You get all dressed up like a bride, and you're now the bride of Christ. Like, I remember that much. But I just found what you were talking about in the book. Maybe you can share that with the listeners, because that doesn't sound esoteric to me. That sounds pretty Christian-based. But go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the first mission, as we know, was led by Neil Armstrong, but his second was Buzz Aldrin, of course. And Buzz Aldrin was a Freemason, but also a member of a Christian community, and he was a devout Christian. And before takeoff, he actually had a discussion with the local, I'm not sure what they're called, vicar or priest or, you know, religious, the priest of the congregation. And he had a chat with him and say, how can we give a more symbolic take? We're going to the moon. It's a very scientific and technological operation, but I would like to give it a wider context. And before leaving, Buzz Aldrin was given a little wafer and a little bit of wine, And when the Eagle, which was the little lunar module, when the Eagle landed on the lunar surface, Buzz Aldrin quietly performed communion. Neil Armstrong was not interested. He just was there along with Buzz in the cabin, but he did not partake in the rite, if you want. And now NASA were quite worried about this because the previous year, Christmas, actually on Christmas Day, 1968, so that was about 6 months before the actual moon landing, Apollo 8 went to the moon and circled the moon and came back without landing on the moon. And on Christmas Day, the three astronauts read a few verses from Genesis aloud, and it was broadcast to the whole population. And NASA was taken to court by somebody in the U.S. who was incensed that there should be any religious reference to the space program. So when Buzz Aldrin told NASA that he was going to perform communion, NASA were very nervous and said, okay, you do that, but you just keep it very quiet, and which is why it's not so well known, but it's not a secret either. It's quite easy to find this information, even though myself, I didn't know it just a few years ago. So it's not a secret, and actually Buzz Aldrin mentioned that himself in his autobiography. But that's the reason why it's not so well known, because NASA were very nervous about the whole thing.
And yet it excludes anyone who's not Christian. What about the Muslims? What about, you know, people of Jewish persuasion or atheists or agnostics? Like, this was supposed to be for mankind.
Absolutely, and that's something I mentioned in the book, because indeed on the moon, Neil and Buzz left a piece of rock on which it was written that basically this mission came for all mankind. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of contradiction in terms in laying that steel and at the same time performing a Christian rite. But actually, Buzz realized that a few years later. He said, yeah, if I had to do it again, I would not do that, because we came for all mankind, so to speak. So he made amends late a few years later.
Do you know any stories that you might want to share, or details that surprised you when you started to really research what happened, how it impacted the astronauts, how they felt? Like, I'm sure you did quite a bit of research there. Is there anything you'd like to share around that?
Yeah, well, definitely this communion on the moon was for me a big surprise. But we just talked about that. Otherwise, I think it's, for me, it was very interesting to look into the accounts by the astronauts of their experience in space. And maybe the most famous one, a few of these experiences were very religious, or spiritual rather than religious, I should say, spiritual in nature. The most famous one is probably from Apollo 14, Edgar Mitchell. And Edgar Mitchell landed on the moon, and when he was coming back to Earth, he had what he described later as a Savakalpi Samadhi experience, which is a kind of experience of unity consciousness. And it was a profound spiritual experience. And when he came back to Earth, he created the Institute of Noetic Sciences in order to try to bridge the gap between science and spirituality, if you want. But that's the most famous one. But a few other astronauts actually had intimation of God. That's how they describe their experience when they were on the lunar surface. Jim Irwin, for instance, I think it was Apollo 15, was looking for rocks on the moon, which was his job, and suddenly he had the impression of, you know, of a divine presence all around him. Now, it's not to say that all astronauts had spiritual experiences, but a few of them had quite profound ones. And I suppose it's I mean, we how to put that? And somebody called Frank Wright wrote a book which he called The Overview Effect. And what he described is that the overview effect is this feeling of unity that one finds when in space and looking back at Earth from outside. And suddenly there is this sense of unity, profound sense of wholeness, of unity for the Earth in general. And that certainly has affected a number of astronauts as well, right, when they looked back to Earth.
I can imagine it when you see Earth and you consider us as Earthlings or as human, as one thing, as opposed to all these broken divisions again that we have based on whether it's religion or race or whatever people are doing. I would imagine being in space looking at this whole and going, that's us. That's we are a we. All of us would be profoundly spiritual.
Well, and if I may throw in and add to that, Tasha, is the one point in your book, and I think it was Bean, I think you said his name was, the one astronaut who, you know, as he was traversing and he was supposed to be reporting back and doing all of his things, he got caught in the awe of it all. And he lost track of time to report back to NASA and everything as well, where that would happen to these guys as they're, you know, they're orbiting these planets. And I could only imagine myself, you're taking it all in. All of a sudden, you're not thinking of the time. You're stuck in that oneness place. Yeah. And when he came back, the one traffic controller from NASA said, "You'll never fly for me again." Right? You know, because he got too caught up. And then all the other astronauts were more on top of their game to make sure they paid attention.
Yes, absolutely. But that's an interesting tension between reason and faith, I suppose.
Or doing and being.
Between reason and revelation.
Mm-hmm. You call it also a story of homecoming, a space odyssey in the mirror of the soul. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I call it a homecoming because for me, there are two ways to look at the mission, really, and that's what I'm trying to put forward in the book. One way is to look at it as a conquest, as Apollo, god of the sun, landing on the moon and basically victorious over the moon. And the moon being the first, as we see now, actually, being the first stage for further expansion into space. And one way to look at the mission, therefore, is to look at it as us, humankind, exporting our solar consciousness into space. And this very solar consciousness that is today killing the Earth. The other way to look at it is to look at it as the sacred marriage between sun and moon, giving birth to Earth, as I mentioned before. And in that sense, it's symbolized by this magnificent picture of Earth taken by Apollo 8, actually, of the Earth floating in the dark of space, which really has been such an iconic picture for the environmental movement, but I think for humanity in general. I suppose most people know that picture, and it has really, I think, contributed to shift the consciousness into a planetary consciousness, the realization that suddenly we were basically on a very finite planet and we'd better take care of her. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, that's why I call it a homecoming, because I think it's collectively, it's about turning our gaze back to Earth. And of course, individually, but I'm only talking about myself, it's also about trying to achieve that elusive psychological sacred marriage.
Maybe they're connected deeply, because in that sacred marriage, if we're all doing that internally, part of that is the feminine, which is nurturing and caring, and we're being called to care for the Earth and cultivate that. So maybe they go hand in hand. Maybe they're not different at all in a way.
No, absolutely. And I totally agree. While the inner mirrors the outer and vice versa, as we know. or as the esoteric community knows, since has known for many, many millennia. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So, so my question next is then, when we take a look at the Earth from the Moon, and you know, it opens up that whole environmental consciousness because you speak of that image. How does that relate now to everything that's happening for us going to Mars? We made it to the Moon, and then they stopped shortly after. They stopped going to the Moon for whatever reason. I'm not even sure why that was for sure. But what does it mean now we're going, you know, we're putting all this effort, energy, resources into going to Mars? What does astrology kind of connect that and our evolution as a species as well?
Well, I think there is an impulse anyway in humans to explore. So I don't think we can deny the fact that there is a very strong impulse to go out there and further, you know, further away. And that's fine. That's, I suppose, that's part of our nature. What is for me, what concerns me is with which consciousness are we doing that? Is it a consciousness of exploitation, like we've been doing to the Earth? It looks like it is. And it's also a consciousness of separation, countries versus countries, and who is going to get there first. So I think that's what is more concerning, is the fact that we are basically exporting the very consciousness that is so damaging to the Earth and is threatening us, actually.
Your mic's off.
Sorry, Tasha. But even, you know, part of me thinks that there's a little bit of a fear consciousness that drives that as well, because of the fear that our planet's not going to last, the damage that we've done to it. You know, there's part of me that thinks if we took those resources to take care of our own planet, do we need to start populating another one?
Yeah, I have to say this sounds so preposterous to me, you know. Who wants to live on Mars where, you know, you have to live underground basically or in giant bubbles, and when we have this amazing planet just under our feet? I just don't get it.
Crying for us.
Yeah. And just the idea of shipping 7 billion people anyway somewhere else, it just doesn't make sense at all.
Astrologically, because I don't know, or maybe it's mythologically, Mars represents, is it war? In my mind, I'm thinking war, but I could be dead wrong. Is that correct?
No, you're absolutely right. Mars was the god of war for the Romans. For the Greeks, it was Ares. And it was... especially for the Greeks, he was a pretty bloodthirsty god, really crying for blood. Now, in astrological terms, it's a bit different. Mars really represents the masculine principle, very much so, while Venus is the feminine principle, is a goddess. And Mars is definitely symbolizes an archetype of masculinity, virility, action, drive, energy, you know, all these things.
Right. So again, in terms of your original exploration of sun and moon, it would be leaning once again, this movement to Mars is leaning once again to the masculine drive to a destination as opposed to a state of being. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. You can put it in those terms. And, you know, the irony is that the mission to Mars is going to be called Artemis, which is the goddess of moon.
The goddess of hunt, so, did you say?
Of the moon and of moon. Hunt as well, yes, of the hunt, but of the moon. So maybe that will be my next book.
Wow.
Well, I certainly find it fascinating when we take a look at, you know, all these instances, how it all connects. Now, I know this is kind of out of left field, and we talk about, you know, the space race just to get to the moon, And, you know, now it's the race to get to Mars. But what would you say to all of those people out there? Because I was devastated when I heard this as a, I was probably a mid-teenager, you know, the first time I ever heard about it, that, you know, about, and I don't even want to say conspiracy, but there's a belief that people say we never actually made it to the moon.
Yeah.
What would you say to them? Because I totally want to believe we did, yet it's out there that people do disbelieve that. So how does that correlate?
Well, I thought about it, of course, and I very early on in the book, I'm just saying I don't entertain conspiracy theories because it's going down the rabbit hole big time, and I don't want to do that. But I have to say, in terms of, if we look at it just symbolically, I actually don't think it matters that much whether we did go or not. The important thing is that we believe we, if you follow my drift. So
could you say it again?
From my own perspective.
Out, Philippe.
Okay.
Could you just repeat that?
What I'm saying is, from my own perspective, I'm not sure it matters that much whether we did go to the moon or not. Because I look at it symbolically. I think for me, the important thing is that collectively, we believe we did. And therefore, the symbolic message to me is still valid. I mean, conspiracy theories, they bound about many, many different things. And as I say, it's going down the rabbit hole big time. So I didn't want to do that. I think, like everything, it's a matter of belief. So how do you challenge belief? If there is, you know, if you believe the earth is flat, then no amount of evidence is going to change your mind.
Yeah. No, and I can appreciate that. I just thought I'd ask the question because I heard it and I was always shocked. I still believe we did. And I know that they're planning to go back there again and do some work there as well. So yeah. It just always some space travel has always fascinated me. So it's, you know, to see what's going on and, you know, the way things have changed just in the past 70 years, you know, since they started and what they're able to do now is really quite, you know, spectacular. And what's going to happen in the future is even still more unknown, I think. But it's just one of those things that I always thought was interesting. And I loved your answer, quite frankly, in terms of just doesn't matter whether we did or not. It's that belief and then the possibility and everything that came. And I think, you know, again, when you look at all these astrological timings, there's something there to me that makes me question things even more.
Yeah, I have to say for the record, I absolutely believe we did.
Yeah, who knows? My question would always be, what would make you think we didn't? Right? But let's not go there.
Yeah, no, exactly. I don't want to go down that road. I'm just, because people do, some people say that. So I was just like, you know,
there's
so what would we say?
Lots of rabbit holes. There are so many.
More now than ever before.
Than ever before. All rocks have been turned over and the rabbit holes are exposed. It's just, are you going to jump or not? So let me ask you, what do you think the most important takeaway from landing on the moon is? What's the most valuable learning that we can, as people, integrate from that incredible moment?
Well, for me, the learning is Earth. That's the teaching. The teaching of the mission is, even though the book is about the moon, actually the real message of the book for me and of the mission is Earth. It's really this homecoming. It's coming back to Earth, basically.
And say more about what that looks like, sounds like, feels like for you coming home.
Well, I think for me it's about engaging with Earth in a different way, away from that objectifying, separating consciousness and connecting to Earth with the heart and not with the mind. I mean, of course, the mind still has a role to play. I'm not saying, you know, away with the mind, not at all. But what I'm saying is we are suffering from the over mind, from too much mind. Mm-hmm. And it's high time we actually reconnect with the earth, with the heart. And when we do, things will look very, very, very different.
You call it in your book, the heart, the true organ of perception.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So tell us what just a little bit more about what you mean when we're aware of the heart being the true organ of perception.
Well, I think it's about compassion. It's about the ability to attune to the suffering of a forest, for instance, or the suffering of an ocean or a river, not to mention animals, because our treatment of animals is absolutely appalling. And I really think the day when we realize what we have been doing to animals, we are going to be facing such a huge dark shadow that it's going to be very difficult to cope with it. But that's for me, that's this ability to feel. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I'm concerned with what technology is doing to us, for instance. I think screens, for instance, are putting literally a screen between us and the earth more and more increasingly. And, you know, when you were talking earlier about polarity and the fact that everything seems so polarized, I think so much of that is the result of, you know, our interaction with screens and social media. It has polarized to such an extent. But it's also preventing us increasingly, and especially with the young, I think, with children, they are being raised in an environment which is totally artificial, and therefore they are not developing this, this ability to feel what it is to be a forest on fire, and to really feel it, not to look at it in on the mm-hmm. newspaper or on TV and look at it from outside. Really feel that that process deep within. I think mm-hmm. that's the only way we can really save ourselves, I suppose, although I don't want to sound too negative or, you know.
but it's true. It's what's called for change to heal ourselves and the planet, to feel like a we. Yeah. So we're almost out of time. I just want you to connect with our listeners where they can get your book, Scavengers of Beauty, a personal, cultural, and symbolic exploration of the moon landing. Where is it available? And also, if you could give your website, so if people want to talk to you, they can.
Yeah. Well, the book is going to be published on the 28th of August, 2020.
My birthday. So, astrologically, my birthday.
Wonderful. And it can be pre-ordered now from the usual online platforms like Amazon or others. It's also going to be available as an ebook, I think within 1 week or 10 days. Will be on Kindle, for instance. As for getting in touch with me, the best thing to do is email. I'm afraid I'm not very conversant with social media myself. I try to stay away from it for different reasons. But anyway, I'm very happy to receive emails, inquiries, comments, whatever. And the email is scavengersofbeauty@gmail.com.
Easy. Well, we so appreciate Easy. You being our guest. Thank you for joining us.
Yes. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah,
thank
it's really so been much. Eye-opening around some of that information and those interesting facts of the moon landing. And I love your timely message about the Earth. I think we can all agree that, you know, Mother Earth, Gaia, needs our attention now more than ever before in history. And, you know, it's our survival. That's paramount with that too. So thank you very much for taking the time today.
Thank you to both of you. I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Okay, everyone, you can catch this show. It'll be up on consciouslivingradio.org, available as a podcast, and also will air live on 100.5 FM in Vancouver Co-op Radio this Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Thanks for joining. Till bye, everyone.
Thanks. Bye now.
Providing support for our cities for almost 40 years and has been vital to helping thousands of community members through the COVID-19 crisis. To find out how you might benefit from the Greater Vancouver Food Bank's services, or to learn how you might donate money or volunteer your time, please visit their website at foodbank.bc.ca.
You have been listening to Conscious Living Radio. For free show downloads, additional information about our guests and topics, or details about upcoming programs, check us out at consciousliving.org.